Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Highly successful and efficient people all have one thing in common. They all read, or at least listen. Now listeners of the show can get a free audiobook when you sign up for a free 30-day trial of Audible. You can keep the book even if you decide to cancel. Go to audible.blueboxdigital.com to sign up today. And now, on with the show. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to Think Outside the Blue Box. I'm Anthony Rivera. I'm the lead videographer and editor here at Blue Box Digital, and welcome to the podcast. This is a podcast about creative journeys, the hustlers, the entrepreneurs, the people that are out there just following their dreams, doing what they love. And today I'm honored, man. I'm joined by the one and only Mr. Hit Record, Joe Lopez.
Hey, man. Thank you for having me. Definitely a pleasure to be here, and salute to the platform, you know, because again, like you said, everybody is on their own journey. Creatives, it's always great to stick together. We kind of go through, like you said, hustles and things that other people who aren't a part of that lifestyle, so to speak, wouldn't ever really understand. Yeah, they don't get it, all the things that go into it. So even if it's different styles, like whether it's video production or audio production or whatever it is, there's definitely a relatability, and It's great to be on the platform and be able to just swap stories, man.
Thanks, man. Thanks for joining me, dude. And you and I have done some work together, man. We actually won an award.
Mm-hmm.
We won a Telly Award for one of our videos.
Yes. Well,
let's talk about that, man.
Yeah, that's you know, the record's called One and Only with a fellow artist, Nat Keza, you know, from Sarasota.
Yeah, shout out to Keza, man.
And she's actually the one who introduced us, made the link, so definitely shout out to her. You know, that the record, how that record came about, you know, me, I started as an artist and kind of ended up morphing into this all-in-one producer, engineer, songwriter, out of, you know, necessity in a lot of cases. I started recording music when I was like 14 years old. And obviously, I had no money for recording studios. I didn't know anybody who made beats. I didn't know whatever. So essentially,
and do everything yourself.
Yeah, put everything together myself. So with this record that I did with Nat, that was actually, I believe, we talked about it off air, as the last record that I put out as an artist before COVID and everything happened. Obviously, I'm still very active and consistent as a producer. But I had the record, and a lot of times, just a little peek behind the window, as a songwriter and as a producer, a lot of times I'll demo records. So I had, you know, a hook idea for that beat, and I was kind of playing with it. And as I'm starting to record to it, my initial thought was, oh, this would be a good record to collaborate with a female artist on. So Nat and I had talked for a while about, you know, doing some records together. And I was like, you know what? Let me see if she would be down to maybe collab with me on this. And she heard it. She really liked it. We kind of went back and forth on some ideas. And it kind of started morphing to where I was like, okay, maybe instead of me just, you know, giving this away to an artist or shopping this to an artist, maybe this becomes her and I on this. And, you know, I don't like to do things halfway. So it was one of those things where it was like, hey, if I'm going to step back into these shoes and push a record as an artist and go through those processes, let's do a visual, you know. And she had worked with you in the past and, you know, showed me some of the people. And I have a lot of people, too, in my Rolodex. But I was really impressed with the work, and I was like, hey, let's get this guy involved, which I'm happy, and you know, we were able to really put together, I think, a strong treatment, a strong story, and the way, you know, visualized it, and then you were really able to help edit it, put the you know, vision into motion there,
and tell
the story. And I think that's what it's all about, you know, whether it's visually, you know, audio-wise or whatever, music videos. It's all about a story, and the record's called One and Only, Mr. Hit Record, Nat Kazza. If you haven't heard the song or checked the video, make sure you check it out, because I do think that the video really helps convey a story that even elevates, you know, the value of the song. And I'd like to think that's why we went ahead and snagged that award. It's because, you know, it's one of those types of things that you kind of you get lost in it. Like, you know, you're watching almost this mini movie, but to a vibey song, you know what I mean? And I'm really happy with the way it came out.
Catchy, yeah.
You know, so I appreciate your help on it, and shouts out to Nat. You know, that was a really fun project that unfortunately kind of got derailed before it could really max out potential. Right after that, we actually did an event with Ja Rule and B103.9. You know, we had our music.
Yeah, I remember. I actually shot the behind the scenes documentary for
lead up
to the Ja Rule show.
It was crazy. It was like, what one of the things about that time period is that, like, it's almost etched in stone now, right? So mm-hmm. It's like one of the cool things was, like, because of the evolution of that record coming together with Nat and the momentum of that video and some of the other things that my brother and I had going on, and we ended up, you know, landing the Ja Rule event and our music being put back into rotation on radio. You know, and doing like the radio press runs and all those types of things, you know, it kind of cemented a moment in time that, like, right, that was like the last thing before the world changed, so to speak. And you know, it's something that I'll always remember, that time period, kind of because of everything that happened with COVID. And although it forced a switch up in the way of some of the things that I was approaching in life and professionally,
business
priorities, etc. And in many ways, and, you know, which ended up being good things. But at the time, like I said, I can look back to that time and say, you know, like, I kind of can remember it vividly, because it was like, hey, like, right, that Ja Rule show, I want to say it was a week later. Maybe not even, and everything shut down, and it's
just, I remember even posting some like the social media posts that we were posting, mm-hmm. and I'm like, is this ever going to happen again? Are we ever going to see a live audience like this ever again?
Right, right.
It was a sad time, man.
So it was almost like, ceremonial in some mm-hmm. ways, you know. It's like you said, being able to perform in front of all these people, large crowds, and then all of a sudden the crowds are gone. And it's like, you know, again, it's almost like a story in itself, you know what I mean? And you know, it kind of forced us, society and creators into the house, and, you know, forced us to develop other means to tell those stories, and, things like, you know, platforms like these kind of, not that they didn't exist prior, but really started to grow and spotlight and now things have been, quote unquote, getting more back to normal, but a lot of the things that were also developed and created in those times still live today.
It's still here,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's
so we're back to, quote unquote, normal, but it's a different normal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's definitely different. And with some of the artists and stuff that I work with now, it's like, there's one in particular who she got her start kind of through the pandemic. So, like, the approach, it's almost like backwards in a lot of ways from the conventional thinking of, like, how somebody needs to or needed to develop before they started garnering fans or attention or whatever. And, like, you know, somebody like me who's been doing music and been in the music industry for 15, 20 years, you know, like, you would get into the studio, you would create your songs, you would get your kind of local neighborhoods behind you, you would do shows and showcases, and eventually that would lead to bigger stages and bigger crowds and, you know, more networking with radio stations, and hopefully the DJ plays my song in the club, and, like, you know, really face-to-face. And I remember, you know, the eras of throwing, you know, packages of CDs in the trunk and
oh, yeah.
you know, going city to city and you know, selling CDs to eat that night, you know what I mean? And really riding out and having that type of mentality toward building a brand and building as an artist. The girl that one of the main artists I work with now is a young lady, Gabby B, who's a Brazilian pop artist based out of Miami. And she essentially started in the pandemic, and she has over 3.5 million followers on just TikTok, you know, verified in IG and all these things, and has captured a humongous audience and started in a time that you weren't even able to go do shows. You weren't even able to go network with the local DJ or do these things. And what's kind of crazy to think about now is she's someone who has already established a lot and garnered a lot of these numbers and momentum, things that most independent or local artists never achieve as far as the amount of people that see her stuff or hear her music or watch her content. And she's only now starting to do festivals, because wow. now festivals are a thing again. Like, you know, in December, you know, she opened for Flo Rida, and actually Ja Rule was there too.
Nice.
At Dare Nightclub in Miami at the Hard Rock. And you know, that was actually her first club performance. Which again is almost mind-boggling from seeing it from my perspective, right? Like looking at it through the lens of my perspective, that, you know, this at the time 21-year-old girl's first show is inside the Guitar Hotel, you know,
wow.
opening for Flo Rida and Ja Rule, and Jake Paul is there and Logan Paul is there, and, you know, Justina Valentine, who she, you know, we have a record with, you know, she's there and performing, and it's her first club performance.
That's wild.
You know what I'm saying? And it's just like if you rewind time, there would almost be no circumstance where that could ever happen in the past. And,
yeah.
and again, it's sort of what we talked about, like how some of the carryover through COVID and the world shutting down, so to speak. It's like
everybody shift.
Yeah. Everybody had to shift and adapt and you know, how the saying goes, you know, adapt or die. You know what I mean? Like with the arts and artists and people in general, as things have morphed, right? Like there, like we talked about, like even in the music industry, there's a lot of things that have stuck around through the quote unquote COVID times that have now become the norm in promoting or marketing yourself as an artist. Like I have friends who are on major labels or signed to labels and things like that, who the game plan is TikTok. The game plan is Instagram Reels. That's before
pre-pandemic. That
yeah.
wasn't even
TikTok,
you know,
well,
as for kids,
yeah,
right?
Who cared about TikTok, right? And now, like, TikTok is probably the number one medium as far as breaking new music new artists in particular. And again, like 2-3 years ago, it barely existed, mm-hmm. let alone was a factor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah, everyone who I talked to was like, TikTok, isn't that for kids? Like the kids dancing videos? Like, what is that?
Right.
No. They didn't know it was going to be the next powerhouse.
Man, I have friends, like I said, who are signed to labels, and the strategies are, hey, before we invest in your music video, before we invest marketing dollars into your record or try to take this to radio, or try to do Spotify, YouTube campaigns, Apple Music campaigns, what have you, we need to see if it's connecting. And so, like, you have...
It's like a testing ground.
Right. And so, like, you have musically creative individuals who aren't necessarily always 100% savvy as content creators. And it becomes very difficult for people who, to like you said, pivot or adapt. Like, you know, I have some friends like who are amazing vocalists, but if you stick a phone in front of them and say, make some, you know, 10-second video that's with your song that's going to be catchy enough to help a wave happen with whatever is going on, and then that's going to be one of the determining factors on whether or not the label is going to allocate budget toward the project. It's a weird space. You know what I mean? And that has become the norm, and you see more and more where being a recording artist or kind of in many facets, but you know, I speak from that lens because that's what I'm most familiar with. But being a recording artist nowadays is as much being a content creator as creating music.
Absolutely.
You know, you really need to be able to balance both. And I think that's why even through COVID and everything, and after we've kind of even gotten back more to normal, and I've seen it firsthand, why even I decided, okay, from the artist side, I'm cool on that right now. You know what I mean? It's not even I've lost the passion to create or, you know, to make music. But I don't have personally, I have the understanding, but I don't have the passion to do the things that I know that are necessary.
You need to do.
Right, on the TikToks or the reels of the world. But now if you know, like somebody like Gabby, who's 21, 22-year-old, beautiful girl, and not only is she a very talented vocalist and music artist, but she's a belly dancer. She creates her own costumes. She has good personality. And she comes from this generation who is just like used to.
They grew up with this phone in their hands their entire childhood.
So it's just an extension of them. So for many, not for all, but for a lot. Mm-hmm. And with all those things combined, you know, people really start to fall in love with the overall person, at least the social media perception of that person. The persona, that's a good way to put it, of that person. And, you know, I forgot the exact figure, but it's something like 50,000 songs or something a day come out on Spotify. It's a lot. I don't misquote me if that's not the exact, you know, but it's a lot, right? And like you said, it's an ocean, and it's very saturated, and it's one of the things that it's like the gift and the curse of technology, right? Anybody with a laptop and a microphone can create a song. Anybody with an iPhone or editing software can create a music video nowadays, right? And you know, it's good and it's bad, right? Because it pushes that creativity, allows people who may never have had that opportunity before to allow their visions to be heard and seen.
Yeah, it makes it more accessible.
Right? At the same time, you know, it creates so much saturation that, you know, it's harder for people who take it more seriously. It's harder for people who are trying to rise, you know, so the cream rises to the, you know, to the top and everything. Like, it's hard for that. It's hard for people to rise through the saturation. Now, at the end of the day, just like anything else in life, you know, survival of the fittest, you know, the strong survive. But it's a different kind of strength, right? Like even in the music industry, not that it ever really was. People like to think that it was, but like somebody can have the most amazing voice in the world. But that's really only one small piece of the equation. They can have great lyrics or be a quote-unquote dope rapper or whatever the case is. But that's only one piece of the equation. And sometimes, I hate to say it, it's not even the most important piece to the equation. And same thing, like, you know, with on the video side, you know, I'm sure that you get it all the time where it's somebody's like, why would I pay you XYZ? Why would I come to you and your company? My homeboy down the street, he'll shoot this video for me for $50, or he'll do this for whatever it is. And it's like, you know, that saturation of justifying your work, you know, people don't realize what you've invested in your skill set,
in your craft,
in your knowledge, in your equipment, in the work hours, and your experience throughout the process. And
I've really seen that with photography, man, because I work with a lot of photographers. And
sure.
I've seen, because phones have gotten so good nowadays, that it's indistinguishable almost.
Right.
So it's kind of like almost anybody can just pick up a phone and be as good as a photographer. So I've definitely dealt with that in my industry.
And then it comes back to adapt or die, right? Because, mm-hmm. like, you know, when we were kids, Blockbuster was the thing. Now Blockbuster, you know, there's one left and it's an Airbnb. You know what I mean? And so it's one of those things that, again, technology forces people to adapt and forces mm-hmm. people to change. And if you don't really realize, like, okay, I need to make adjustments and whatever. And it's, you don't necessarily have to follow waves or follow particular trends or whatever. But if you're not educated to be able to make the decisions, to know how to maneuver, you're kind of going to be dead in the water. So it's really interesting across the board as content creation, as just a whole. I mean, you know, I worked for ESPN for 4+ years. You know, I worked for other networks and dealt with, you know, major platform things. And even when it comes to stuff like cable, right? Obviously, cable is still a thing, but now you have, you know, Sling TV and YouTube TV, and everything's application based. And, you know, ESPN has their own app now. Like, mm-hmm. I remember, like, even being there. And like I said, like, I had left not too long ago, and the precipice of the app was still really a new thing. Even like in the time that I was there, and where it's developed to now is crazy. And it's one of those things that if you're not, like, even on that level, basically, if you're not adapting, you're gonna get drowned out. You see all these conglomerates pairing together, and you know, Netflix starts to work, and so you have Hulu, and then you have Disney Plus, now you have Peacock and
Paramount,
and, right? Yeah. And if you're not, you know, at first it was like Netflix isn't cable. You know what I'm saying? Now you have Peacock and Paramount. Mm-hmm. Like, if they're not in the game, they're dead.
That's it.
You know, and these are historic brands that we've all known, that our, you know, ancestors grew up on, even. And if they're not ahead of the curve, then they die. And I think that's an important lesson for photographers, for videographers, for music producers, music artists. You know, you need to continue to innovate. You need to continue to be able to be flexible and change, to stick to your guns, to be who you are as an individual. I'm not saying that you just, you know, do something. Like, don't just jump on TikTok because everybody's doing TikTok. Be informed. But, like, if you're not a part of that, then you also need to figure out what's the next TikTok, mm-hmm. right? What's the thing for you that helps break through that saturation? And it's not everybody has the same exact path, but, you know, it is necessary to have the information, you know, with everything you got at your hand, so you know how to maneuver the game, man.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of the CNN Plus. Mm-hmm. How it just completely flopped, because, I mean, they were trying to kind of stay in the streaming business, but they didn't cut it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know. Again, I think, like, even while I was at ESPN, there's a lot of things that happen behind the scenes in these types of big places, and they take shots at certain things, and at the end of the day, you know, the viewers, the people, the audience really ends up being the biggest factor into these equations. So it's like, I hear all the time, like, people like, oh, nobody supports me, or nobody this, or nobody that. And at the end of the day, garnering that support, you need to have a product that is something that people want to engage with. And sure, it's harder. It's more difficult if you don't have the financing. It's harder. It's more difficult because of the saturation, whatever. But at the end of the day, even if you have all those things, mm-hmm. if you're not making the type of product that people want to consume, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's irrelevant.
Yeah, so I think like even at ESPN, like, you know, I mix SportsCenter for, you know, the majority. Like that was like my main show that I worked on. And, you know, they tried different iterations of SportsCenter essentially. And now where SportsCenter is back to is, I mean, it's not like it was in the 90s, like what they consider the golden years, yeah. because of the, you know, the talent of that. But they've gotten back to sports highlights, you know, they do some touch political sometimes, but they try to stay yeah. away from it. Because at the end of the day, it's like if I wake up in the morning and I want to catch the highlights from the night before, or if I'm going to sleep at night and I turn on SportsCenter before I go to bed, I just want to see the highlights.
Honestly, man, like everything's so politicized nowadays right. that you just want to turn your brain off, just hear a little bit of sports, you know, I just want to catch up yeah. on stuff.
And I think that's maybe some of the issue with like CNN, for instance, with CNN Plus. It's like the audience that they've built isn't necessarily fully conditioned for the streaming.
Yeah.
So like sure. that works against them in that world where it's like, hey, I just want to be able to pop on the TV and hear, see my talking head.
Yeah.
And, you know, like now there's all these different, you know, before CNN kind of was the only game in town as far as 24/7 news and whatever. Now there's other options. So yeah. if you don't want to hear it or see it, you have somewhere else to go. At the same time, you know, if the audience that is engaged, and I understand trying to grow your audience and trying to be innovative and but their current audience, at least, they want what they want, and what they didn't want
very specific.
Yeah. wasn't the yeah. app based news.
I heard that it's also because they have so many contracts out there that it's kind of like they can only be on CNN.
Yeah.
Like whenever they started their platform, there was a lot of stuff that they couldn't take off of right. cable. Like they had to create new content, which I think was their downfall, is the new content that they started creating was just not, it's not what CNN is. Like
right.
you said, it's like the 24/7 news cycle kind of thing. That's what they pioneered and that's what everybody goes there for.
Yeah. And I think, like I said, even ESPN dealt with that, because it's like, if I'm the NFL, right. And I'm ESPN and I have a contract, let's say with Monday Night Football. Mm-hmm. And part of that contract is, you know, you're obviously doing it. Well, maybe not obvious to the audience, but one of the reasons why a major network would pay the NFL to air their games is so they can go get advertisement dollars for commercials. And so one of the big,
so it affects them.
Right. So one of the big pushes against something like an app is, okay, well now if it's airing in different places for an advertiser, how can we promise a certain amount of eyeballs and the analytics that measure up to us being able to garner the money back to merit the investment it takes to get the, you know, to pay for the package to begin with. So then there's places that obviously, like if you have certain things that you now can't play on the app versus playing on the terrestrial mm-hmm. station and things like that, it does affect it. I think the difference with something like ESPN, where they were smart, is that there was other sport, hockey, there mm-hmm. was MMA, there was other sports that really couldn't always get the shine in, you know, in a 30-minute hour sports center. If there's like right now, like, you know, like I don't want to date the podcast because who knows when it comes out. But during right this second, the Kevin Durant situation is a big deal. We, you know, at him requesting a trade and with Kyrie Irving and everything, and so that's gonna dominate
the news cycle.
You know, the news cycle like crazy. Mm-hmm. But if you want other things now the app and you know you have more tapped into Whereas in the typical news cycle, it's almost already exists, right? Like, you have local news, right? You have the ability to get those other ancillary pieces of content that isn't necessarily going to be on CNN anyway, and unless you're doing, unless you have other high profile, let's say podcast creators, who are coming with enough of an audience themselves, like you see places like Spotify and even like Barstools and whatever, those are like the new networks. And again, it's that adaptation where CNN, I think that's maybe the swing and the miss that they tried, but you need the talent, you need the product that they care about to, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you had the people that, you know, like you said, if they had some exclusive content that was exclusive to the app that you couldn't get on CNN,
that was good,
then people would eventually cross over into it. But it is hard, you know, obviously, to, like, I know that Netflix obviously has a ton of content that's custom made and things like that. But
even they're losing, bro. They're losing a lot of money.
They're losing because of that.
It was the first loss ever in the company's history.
And it's the risk that they take. We'll see how it plays off the long term. But it's like they have to burn so much cash to create this content, you know, that is exclusive to them, but that requires a lot of upfront investment to bring that back. And if they're not garnering necessarily new subscribers from it, and now that there's more competition in the marketplace,
that's the thing, man. With Netflix, at least there was a lot of content that was on there that's no longer on there.
Right.
Especially Disney. They had a huge contract with Disney and Pixar and all that.
Yeah. And with, like,
now that Disney Plus is out, they're kind of hurting.
Mm-hmm. The Office is off
the
of there.
The Office, yeah. You know?
So it's
a lot of stuff pulled to Peacock.
So it's almost necessary, right, for them to continue to make, you know, Umbrella Academy,
innovate,
the Ozarks, and like these shows that are exclusive to Netflix, but they cost a lot of money. And then, you know, in any business sense, you have to weigh out how long can they let that burn, and then is the content good enough that it's
to retain?
Yeah, are you going to retain? And then they got to obviously fix, you know, charge more money, and you know, it comes down to the customers. And you know, I'd hate to see Netflix go away, but it's one of those things. Like, Netflix took out Blockbuster, and do these other competitors now eventually take out Netflix? Because it becomes
battle of the fittest, like you said.
So it all goes back full circle. It's interesting how it works out. And, you know, my daughter's 7 years old, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, when she's in her 20s, when she's in her 30s, what is normal, you know?
What does it look like?
Yeah, like when she has a 7 year old, you know, like you said, like she's grown up with a cell phone. That's all she's ever known.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She's never known a world where she didn't have it. You know what I mean? Like, we were staying at a friend's house, and they had a VCR, and they had, you know, cassette tape players, and you know,
the kids are like, what is that?
Yeah, the old house phones or whatever. And you know, you would have thought she walked into some, you know, ancient history museum or whatever, the way she was looking at some of that technology. And, you know, it's insane to think, like, that technology was looked at, you know, in its day as how Tesla or how whatever, like how
super innovative.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And just how that all how that all changes. And it's really nuts to think, like, even us on this earth, like, you know, like how old they say that the earth is and how long we've really been on it, and then how old our country is in comparison to that versus how long, you know.
I've heard we're a species of amnesia, man, that we have such a short-term memory that
yeah,
such stuff that happened such a long time ago, it's hard for us to even comprehend that that much time actually going by.
It's like when you really start to think about it, it's really insane. And then, like, you know, I watch some documentaries and things at times, and stuff that's even like 1,000 years old, which, you know, none of us are going to live to 1,000, but like 1,000 years old in the scope of how long the world has existed is a drop in the bucket. But like, think about if you know, you were alive 1,000 years ago, you close your eyes and you woke up now, how different the world is in that period of time. So that it's just, what does 1,000 years from now look like? What does 5,000 years look like? You know what I mean?
It's funny watching the Back to the Future movies, because they kind of in the '80s tried to predict what 2020 would be like, and Back to the Future 2, I think. And you see all this like clothing that's 80-ish, but they thought it was gonna be like that in the future. They thought it was gonna have flying cars and flying like all the stuff, and like it didn't turn out to be that way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is insane, and like, you know, what, like you said, what ends up coming to fruition, and then, you know, then there's technology that comes out, and you're like, wow, I would have never thought that was a, you know, a thing,
and like becomes just 5 years ago even.
Yeah. And like I said, like even bringing it back to music and marketing and everything, like, you know, there's things as an artist 5 years ago, 10 years ago, putting together records, marketing yourself as an artist.
So different.
That was like, this is the thing you do that is no longer the thing you do. And, you know, I don't know, this was even probably like 3 or 4 years ago. I had a friend, you know, he got locked up for like 10 years, right? And, you know, he's an artist. He came out, he wanted to do a song. He comes and he does a song. And he was like, hey, can you burn that on the CD for me? And like, my, instinctually, I'm looking for the CD, and I realize, wait, I don't have any, like, we don't do that. Like,
we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I'll put it on a hard drive for you, or email it to you, or whatever. Dropbox. And you know, obviously he wouldn't have known any better. He was, you know, out of the scene for 10 years.
Out of commission.
But it's just like, again, it's like things that, like, that was what you did like 10 years ago when you were done with a session. You burned the session onto a disc or whatever. You had your song on the CD, and that became your master copy. Better not let the CD get scratched. You know what I mean? And then, you know, you make some duplicates. And you know, I remember I used to have like a file cabinet with like my masters on it. You know what I mean? Like where it was like, okay, boom, this is the master of this song. And it's, if a flood happens or whatever, you know what I mean?
You got to keep it in a safe or in a cabinet somewhere. Yeah. So it doesn't get humidity and heat. And I remember those days.
You know, and even at studios, like I would remember, like, we'd have kind of like bookshelves with the artists, you know, some of their files and stuff backed up, and we would charge fees to be like, okay, if you want your stuff, you know, put on this bookshelf of stuff. It's a storage fee. Now you can start charging a storage fee. Obviously, if you're trying to keep it on the hard drive, it's the same principle. But, you know, it was literally like a physical storage fee, because it's like, we can only put but so many CDs in here.
It's taking up physical space.
You know, so it's just, it's interesting to, you know, to throw it back to that. And again, since I started so young,
yeah, man. Let's go back and let's talk about you, man. How did you start? Did you start in music, or did you start writing ESPN? Or
when I was born in, we'll take it way back. I was born in New York in the Bronx.
Nice.
And so, you know, obviously that's like the birthplace of hip hop and everything. And, you know, I'm of Puerto Rican descent, and you know, heavily hip hop influenced family and just environment, right? I remember in like elementary school, my family, we had moved to Connecticut, and where we were in Connecticut was probably about 40-45 minutes from you know, where a lot of the rest of my family was still at in the Bronx. And I remember one of my cousins at his apartment building, whenever we would go visit and, you know, go hang out with the fam or whatever, there would be a bunch of people who were rapping outside of the apartment building.
Love that.
And just ciphering. And I remember as, you know, 6, 7, 8-year-old kid, just having like admiration of how free that was. Right. And like, I remember having this Simpsons notepad. And I remember just jotting down lyrics in the Simpsons notepad. And whenever we would go back and forth between my cousin's house and where we were at in Connecticut, I remember saying, one of these days, you know, I'm going to get my stuff together and I'm going to jump into this cipher. And,
Simpsons notepad.
Yeah. So, one of the times, my dad or whatever, he went up, and I was in the car by myself and I saw them ciphering and, you know, I was definitely less than like 10 years old. And I remember like getting out of the car and they were probably weak as hell, but I don't really remember any of the rhymes. I remember something with Daryl Strawberry was in it. You know, that was like my first taste of being in an environment where, like I said, it felt free and powerful and utilizing my words and my voice and feeling acceptance and people went crazy. And again, it was probably more so of the thought of a kid, you know, rapping or whatever. But at the same time, it didn't matter to me why they were enjoying it. They enjoyed it. I enjoyed doing it. And that was kind of, like I said, the my first taste. And when I moved to Florida, I met a kid. His artist name, he went by Black Flash, like when we were in high school.
Nice.
You know, so we were like 14 and we used to just be in summer camp and just rap in the back of the van, going to like these field trips and whatever. And we would be like, oh man, it'd be like really cool if we could somehow record a song. And I remember at the time, you know, 14, kind of still going through puberty and all that kind of stuff. Like I was insecure about my voice. But I was pretty secure with my writing ability. And I was like, well, what if I helped, you know, write stuff and then either you can rap it or somebody else can rap it if we record. And so like it was the mission of trying to figure out how are we going to record this. And so I remember like the first little like ideas of things that I would try to do was the old, you know, Microsoft computers or whatever had like just like almost what you would consider like voice notes type software in the phones nowadays. And I remember I had like this really cheap $15 mic from Radio Shack and somehow trying to figure out how to play the beat and rap on that. And then we had this little dual tape recorder, like old school tape recorder thing. So
you
like
were totally dating yourself.
Yeah, yeah. So and like where I would record beats like off, like sometimes even off the radio, or like when they would play instrumentals or whatever, and then play that and then record it. Like so that was like the initial, and then software started. Like, I mean, it was already a thing, but I didn't have access to it. I was 14 and whatever. And I don't necessarily condone this, but I went into Best Buy and I stole my first piece of software, Magic Music Maker. And in there they had beat loops and those types of things. And that was really the introduction to starting to learn how to record myself and starting to learn how to put beats together. Because, again, I didn't have access to any of it. And I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have anybody to show me. So I just was figuring it out. And I was probably doing things incorrectly or wrong in traditional standards. But,
hey,
you know.
Dude, that's how you learn, man.
Right? So, like, started recording myself as demos in a way to, like, show other people, like, how I would want them to rap it and da-da-da. And I remember, you know, getting to the point finally, you know, at this point we were just getting to the age 15, 16 where, you know, friends could drive and things like that. And I remember being in the car and having our song on a CD and playing it and like just being like, hey, what do you guys think of this song? Without them knowing like this was my song or this was, you know, music that I created or whatever. And they were really liking it. And then when I, you know, told them like, hey, that's me on the song. And just the reaction again, it's like, it's almost like if, you know, you witnessed like an alien or something like, you know, that at that time in those circles, because again, like nowadays, because it's so available, people recording their own stuff was rare, especially like I said, a 14, 15 year old kid. And so that was my kind of like initial thing into music. And so by the time I was in high school, I was already opening up for big acts even while I was in high school. So I mean, again, dating the times, like, you know, Lil Flip was one of the biggest artists at the time, and I was opening shows for him, and Lloyd was a brand new artist. I had, you know, Lil Scrappy and Trillville, like, so this was that era of, you know, 2003, 2004 era. And like I said, I'm a teenage kid figuring out, okay, you know, how do I make this happen? And so I remember doing an opening for Lil Scrappy, and we brought like 150, 200 kids to this show. And I remember asking the promoter, like, hey, like, it'd be kind of cool, like, if you threw me like a few dollars, like, you know, all these people bought tickets, like, you know, it'd be nice if I get a little percentage of that. And they kind of just were like, no. You know what I mean? And then I was like, well, if we have the power to bring people in the door like this, you know, maybe I can do my own show. So, like, you know, even in high school, whether it was at, you know, high school parties, or, you know, I even booked a venue when I was like 17 years old and threw my own concerts and things like that. You know what I'm saying? While I was in high school. And I ended up getting, you know, I don't know if it was Double XL or what the magazine was, Vibe, I don't know, but it had an ad for Full Sail in there. And at the time, even though this was fun, and, you know, I was starting to get some name recognition and getting out there, I didn't really look at it as this was like a career path option.
Something you could actually do for a living, yeah.
So when I seen the ad in Full Sail, for Full Sail in the magazine, it really intrigued me. I went, I checked out the campus, and I was like, you know, this is what I want to do. I just want to be next to it however I can, you know. And so after I graduated, you know, I moved to Orlando, went to Full Sail, graduated from Full Sail, and while I was, you know, in Full Sail, network with a lot of people that I still have, you know, some relationships with to this day. But, you know, I went for recording arts. So really, like, you know,
your BFA?
No, I actually only have my associates, but the way that it worked at the time, I don't know how it works now, but like the associates was really the program that dealt with the technical side. The bachelor's was then really the music business side.
Gotcha.
Which I felt at the time that if I was just going to get a business degree, it would have been cheaper for me to get it from a different college into
Full Sail. It was way too expensive.
They had the technical things that I wanted. So my first job out of college, while I was now also, you know, pursuing the music artist thing, was there was a local TV station in Fort Myers, Florida, Wink TV, that, you know, liked to hire their audio engineers out of Full Sail.
Nice.
So I really had no experience or thought or really knowledge base on audio for, you know, TV or broadcast or whatever. Obviously, I know I turn on the TV, I hear stuff, whatever, but like I didn't have any education on that. And I remember I went to this interview, if you want to call it that, for, you know, for this job at Wink, and the guy who was interviewing me left me with the current audio guy and was just like, you know, all right, well, basically start training him. And I was like, so I'm guessing I have this job, right? So for years, I sort of balanced that balance, right, of having and learning this the corporate side of doing audio in that environment, and then meanwhile continuing to grow as an artist, a songwriter, a producer, an engineer, and, you know, owning and operating, you know, recording studios and touring. And you know, there was actually an incident in my early 20s where I opened up my own recording studio, and before I could even really launch it, it got broken into.
Oh, geez.
And, you know, that really had put a really bad taste in my mouth. Like, I felt like I was investing a lot of my time and effort into helping other people pursue their circumstances. And at that moment, you know, it really allowed me to take a step back and, with me and my brother, say, okay, hey, we're really going to give this a shot as artists. So at the time, I was really doing more traditional, I guess, hip hop, you know, what people would consider. When me and my brother started creating music together, we fused a lot of sonics together, you know, pop, you know, hip hop, urban pop, Latin, you know, even EDM, and we started fusing these different sonics together, and we created a group called Hands Up Music between the two of us that really elevated, I think, our brand, right, to where in our opportunities. So I remember having a meeting with some of the people that were surrounding us at the time and saying, like, hey, like, we're about to get this train rolling, and it's like, you know, I want to get on the radio. I don't know how to get on the radio, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, as you've seen from my history, like, I never knew how I was going to do certain things or whatever, but, like, I'm going to figure it out, right? And
that's what it is, man. It's the art of figuring it out.
Yeah.
That's
so
it.
We had a record called DWI, and we were doing shows, and we were opening up for a lot of different people. And through those shows, we'd get approached by people in the industry, because they'd be like, wow, you guys really could rock a crowd. Like, people know
sound
who you
really
are
good,
and
yeah.
Da da da. What's going on? What's your situation? So we met some people, and one of the guys was like, he's from Miami, and he worked, you know, with some of the major artists down in Miami. And he's like, if you ever get a record that, like, you're, like, for real about, you know what I'm saying? Like, let me know. I can help work it.
Nice.
And so, mind you, my studio I got broken into. The only thing I had left was a microphone that one of my friends had let me borrow, because he knew that, you know, I was down and out. And then I had an old M-Box that the only reason why it wasn't in the studio was because it was broken. So
wow.
We soldered it back together, and you know, it was me, my brother, and we had a roommate in this you know, apartment that we were living in Fort Myers, and we had the booth set up in the pantry and the recording equipment on the kitchen table, and we made this record called DWI, Dancing While Intoxicated, and that was on the on the cheap microphone on the kitchen table, like, in the pantry or whatever. Those the original vocals were cut there, and I was like, man, there's something about this record that's really catchy and different. DJ Riffic, who, you know, was our DJ, and you know, we do a lot of things with, he was DJing at a spot that night, and I took it down to Naples, and we played it, and
this in there.
Yeah, and by the end of the record, people were singing the record.
Nice.
And I was like, all right, I think we got something for real. So we take
that's
it,
validation.
Yeah,
right,
we
there.
Take it to the guy and things like that, and through some maneuverability, you know, he ends up taking it to Power 96 in Miami, one of the DJs, and saying, like, hey, you know, the guys at Y100 didn't want to play this song. I'm gonna give it to you first. You know, make sure you get on it. And they were kind of like, yeah, cool. And then so he goes and does the same thing to Y100. And I remember getting a call from one of the DJs at Y100, like, hey, send me some drops for the song, you know, And I'll play it tonight.
We're going to put it on. Yeah.
And nice. I was like, all right, boom. I send it to him. And I remember it was like a Thursday night. And the record Starships by Nicki Minaj, I remember that was the record that played before ours. They mixed us in with that, and then Calvin Harris in on Y100. And
that's cool. You'll always remember.
I remember it vividly. I was sitting outside of a hookah lounge, like, you know, oh man, like people were like, hey, you know, everybody wanted to have a good time. Let's go and party. I wanted to hear the song, like, just get that feeling. And like you said, everybody remembers like the first time they got played on the radio, if you got that experience. So, the DJ at, Power 96 saw that the DJ Y100 was playing it. And so he decided, well, if he's going to play it, I'm going to play it twice.
Oh, damn.
You know what I'm saying? So like over that weekend, they started like kind of almost competing with our record. And by Monday, I wake up and then I had an email from Epic Records. And, you know, that was the A&R department. And you know, so we reach out and they're telling us how, you know, the higher ups, they're familiar now with the record. They're curious what we have going on. And, you know, kind of like giving us like things of what they would like to see us do with the record for them to really, you know, get it to where they were, you know, wanting to offer us a deal and everything.
Yeah, they got to make you guys marketable.
Yeah. So again, so I hang up the phone. We're excited. But then we have to have another discussion because it's like, all right, I don't know how to do any of this.
Yeah.
Like, not, like I at this time I have no management. We have no labels. You know, we're pooling resources together.
Just you and your brother, right?
Yeah, me and my brother are DJ. Eventually, you know, we get a you know, an investor, so to speak, but like, you know, investment dollars nowhere near what you know, these major labels are competing with and whatever, but you know, to kind of get us at least kickstarted there, and eventually another station picks us up, and then another station picks us up, and you know, 20-25 stations later, we're getting played, and then we're starting to do shows, like, you know, in different parts of the country, and a radio in Washington State, in Spokane, Washington, they call us and they're like, man, they love this record over here. And we're like, man, we want
to. How did it get way over there?
Like, so we just had people helping us work the song, and we were working it from our angle, and then also the song kind of was growing legs of its own too, like, you know, being like these different DJ pools and circuits, and this DJ would show it to this DJ, or like, you know,
like
some
old school viral,
right? In a way it kind of went old school viral, to where like the station over there in Washington was like, hey, we want you to come perform this record, people really love it. And he's like, you know, I can guarantee you, like, if you come out here, by the time you come out here, it'll be the number one record on the station.
Wow.
So, you know, we you know, negotiate the terms, we set it all up, and so we go out to do like kind of like this little Northwest tour in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and Spokane, Washington, and Tacoma, Washington, and that whole area. And I remember them picking us up from the airport, and he had the stats or whatever on his phone, and so we get in the car. As soon as we get in the car, he turns up the radio, our song is playing, nice. And then, you know, he shows us the stats, and we were number one, you know, there.
Wild.
So it was dope, and, like, people, like, that started to change some of the momentum, you know, in some of those things. So, like, throughout the course of that, you know, we got to do some amazing events. You know, we shared, you know, like I mentioned Ja Rule earlier, but we shared a stage with Lil Wayne and Post Malone and Jeezy and Wayne's brothers, Gabriel Iglesias, Jason Derulo, Pitbull, Flo Rida, you know, Trey Songz, you know, Bubba Sparks, and like all these different people that, you know, we got to see firsthand and be a part of the experiences of performing on the same stages and
be exposed to their audiences.
And it also, it like going through a lot of those experiences, right, started to really showcase a different side to the industry that if you're not that deep in it, you don't really ever get to see, right? So, like, for instance, just as an example, you know, some of these major labels, they're doing campaigns and things like that, and the radio stations and the labels, like, everybody's kind of in cahoots, like, one hand washing the other, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember there was a station in Vegas that liked the song, and they wanted to add it. But then, like, 1 week, Sean Paul had a new song coming out. Okay, so we get bumped because there's only, like, a certain amount of slots that they can fill in with new music.
With new stuff, yeah.
And then, you know, Mariah Carey's new record's coming out, so you're getting bumped. Or Pitbull's new record, Jay-Z's new record's coming out. Damn. And so, like, the way the charts work is, like, the radio charts anyway, is each station is a format. So, like, you have top 40 radio stations, you have rhythmic stations, you have urban stations, right? And then, so, like, in order to really, like, garner charting momentum, you need to have the same type of format stations playing your record all at the same time, because all that aggregate count is what they count for that week. Mm-hmm. As your chart position. So you can have an insane amount of total spins, but if you're not hitting all at the same time, you're not necessarily hitting the charts. And the way that the radio program directors and things like that and the record labels, what they were at the time, what they're looking at is to see people's chart position. So if they see, okay, oh, there's this Hands Up Music group that's coming up, let me go check this song because I see it's on the rise, and then maybe I throw that into my, you know. And so, like, the way that, like, you know, especially then with a lot of artists, their goal was, we have a new record, within the first week, 2 weeks, we need to kill it because we need to get enough momentum that all the other stations see, hear it, jump on it. And then that's why you could, you know, back in the day, you could hear a song on the radio 1 week, and then next week, then it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have the resources to compete with the people that already have these built-in relationships, that already have the funding and the money to be able to shoot the major videos and be able to do the hand washing that they can, you realize, oh wow, like, I'm not fighting a fair fight. So we ended up doing a remix to the record, which included Mims and VIC, which were, you know, both platinum artists in their own right, which helped keep the record alive and thriving. But there was a lot of things that we couldn't do from a financial standpoint, from just a power-based relationship standpoint, that really, to this day, has now morphed into, as I produce now for independent artists, right? I come in with a different perspective. I come in with the perspective of an artist as well, who's had to work things independently and not have some of those, you know, major support systems that these major labels and et cetera have behind them, and like we discussed before, figuring it out. How can mm-hmm. we do it? We might not be able to do everything they do, but I have a saying called maximize the minimum. Like, you know, figuring out, like, what we can do with what's at our fingertips.
That's what you got.
And
yeah.
Doing the best we can with it. And so, like, you know, eventually my daughter, when I say 07, now, like, my daughter was born, and eventually that obviously became priority to me, right? So I couldn't just get up and go do shows for minimal or no money and be bouncing around and be in the clubs every night and da-da-da, you know.
It's a little harder to do.
Right, yeah. So that kind of started shifting my focus to more studio work, to producing again for others, you know, operating studios, and starting to do more, I guess, what is considered safer work, in the sense of, you know, I started doing more corporate stuff, started, you know, investing more time into things like the broadcast audio. And I became a program director myself for radio. And that led to me building up enough a resume that someone like ESPN, you know, came knocking and offered me a position to be an A1, do, you know, be an audio engineer for them. In which case, you know, I like I said, I mixed, like, you know, heavy live programming, the sports centers of the world, the baseball tonights and the, you know, NBA drafts and, you know, a lot of great major programming. And
yeah, how long did you do that?
So, yeah, it was about 4 years that I was at ESPN, and it was a great gig overall. It's one of those things, though, that, you know, in live TV, it's a 24-hour network, it's extremely time-consuming. And as a creative and an entrepreneurial spirit, the thing that wore on me is, like, you know, I have this amazing job. A lot of people consider it a dream job.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for it, don't get me wrong. But at the same time, I feel like every day that I'm here, I'm a day further away from the things that actually I'm passionate about. Like, I'm a creative. I'm like I said, I'm an entrepreneur. Like, and even to this day, like, I get some really good corporate opportunities, and I'll be honest, sometimes they're very hard to turn away.
Yeah.
And I'm not even going to say that I won't go back for periods of time, because, you know, it might be the right decision for the moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do love being able to have the flexibility and the freedom. Like, I live in Atlanta now, and I'm right here in Tampa because I was, you know, able to say, okay, for this week, 2 weeks, I'm going to go to Florida and go to Orlando, go to Tampa, go to Fort Myers, go to Miami, bounce around, network,
do work,
hit all these spots, and have the flexibility and freedom to do that. So it's like, now I'm kind of in a new chapter of my music business life, so to speak. I obviously stayed doing things while I was at ESPN, but music became definitely secondary to that career path in the moment.
And yeah, it becomes more of like a, like you said, like a corporate environment. So it's
right.
Like you have these things that you have to do, and exactly. You can't really go outside of the lines almost.
And it wasn't like it wasn't a 9-to-5, right? Like, I didn't, my schedule would change every day. So it was like, I had to be essentially available for that company, you know, and like, it was my priority, whether I wanted it to be or not.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not hating on it. It's just not long term what I want for myself. And
creative wise,
right?
Kind of, yeah,
and
yeah,
gotcha. Just like personally, just like feeling of you know, I need to be at the beck and call of someone else. And you know, I just think that, like, the struggles of being an independent creator, as you know, you go through the ups and downs.
Sure do.
And it's not, definitely not as consistent of, oh, I know my paycheck is coming, it's going to be this much or around this much or whatever every week or every 2 weeks.
Yeah, you kind of give up that security, but
yeah,
you're doing what you love.
But yeah, there's that passion push toward it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I figure that if I'm going to invest time, I'm going to invest it into myself. I'm going to invest it into the things I'm passionate about, invest it into my family. And, you know, that with being a responsible father and adult and all those things in mind as well. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at now. And in this chapter of Mr. Hit Record and being a producer and songwriter and recording engineer, you know, really being able to tap in with artists who have the foundational pieces that I felt like, you know, I had in some respects, like, and then maybe even more like than I have, like, you know, that have possibly budgets behind them, that have, you know, the quality of music and care and attention into their stage show and their ability to connect with people and tell stories and being able to
work that TikTok.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And do it in exactly and work it,
yeah,
do it in a way that is effective in this day and age. And so I feel like what I provide into the equation is, you know, I can help craft the records with somebody's brand that helps communicate that story through and through, while also giving them an extra set of eyes of experience of somebody who's done.
You've been through
it. Yeah, been through it. You know what I mean? And so nowadays, I don't work with the, like, I don't work with a tremendous amount of artists as I used to when I was just, like, running studios and things when I lived in Tampa, especially, like, but I do, the artists that I am working with, I tend to work with them in a more, you know, all-inclusive way. Like, you know, I'm involved kind of start to finish from, you know,
writing to producing.
Exactly. To the rollouts and thinking, like, you know, of how this all fits in brand building and just, you know, and that's kind of where I think, at least in this phase, I'd like to be. I guess if I had a dream vision, so to speak, I'd love to help be a part of that elevation for another artist and become sort of the guy maybe down the line that can take, you know, an artist from, you know, being in their starting phases, help develop them up, help getting them the records, and either maybe eventually helping getting people signed, or maybe me as a producer, maybe I get production deals where I get budgets or whatever the case is, where I can sign artists.
However
that works out. And time will show and prove, hopefully, that I have those abilities. But, you know, with some of the artists that I'm working with now, obviously my immediate goal is to help them continue to grow, provide the energy and the music and just the overall insight to do so. And then long term, you know, hopefully I can replicate it and create a system to where, you know, I can be a player
that go-to person that people go to
exactly
one-stop shop, man. Yeah,
exactly. So that's kind of where I'm at in a nutshell through the history of Mr. Hit Record and kind of, you know, to where I'm at now, man, and just continuing to grind it out, you know, and taking it a day at a time. And you know, it's funny and ironic at times, like the perception value, you know, sometimes when I'm busy and I'm moving around, sometimes that's not the most not the times when I'm monetizing the most, yet where people perception might be where I'm killing it the most. And then there's other times where it might appear to be quiet or whatever the case is. I do think that what was like a sweet kind of like way that, like, when I left ESPN August of last year, and my first major sync placement since leaving ESPN was with ESPN.
Oh, wow.
So I have a song with Vikina, who signed with Pitbull, and, you know, it's on ESPN, and, you know, they've used it on First Take and NBA Today and, like, all these big shows. And I thought that was like you know, like, again, so like cool. The way the story just kind of, you know, like my first, the irony of that was when I was at ESPN, it was a conflict of interest to have my music on ESPN. So I had a song that they had interest in syncing that they didn't realize it was my song. And then when they figured out that it was my song, they actually had to pull it. But
because it was a conflict of interest,
you know, and I was disappointed at the time, obviously.
Yeah.
But one of the things it garnered me a relationship with the music supervisor there, and, you know, he was able to learn about me and some of my history, and like that I wasn't just some random person that, like, oh, you know, this guy actually does this, to where it's like, here's my email, here's my number, like, you know, again, one of those things. If you ever get something for real.
Yeah.
You know, if you ever leave this place and you're ever working at, like, you have my information type of thing. And you know, I don't take those types of things lightly. Like, for instance, I was able to shop the record directly, which, you know, is rare, as, again, doing things independently. Like, normally there's processes of going through publishing companies and people who have already garnered those relationships. I'll say this, I've only sent one record to ESPN since leaving ESPN, and that's the record that placed on ESPN because me working at ESPN and being somebody who played music, like I know what has the best shot, right? So
like you know what works, but you know what
I knew what would have an opportunity, and I knew when we did the record, Vikina and I, and it's like a Spanglish record, and it's called Champion Cultura, and like just the way the hook was, and it's you know like kind of sports thematic. It was actually originally intended for something completely different, something really? That was a pitch for something for the Super Bowl, and when that fell through, it was like, you know, I have this relationship over here. I'm gonna, you know, I think this record would really work. And so, like, I get hit up all the time. People are like, "Oh, can you send this record to ESPN?" Like, I'm really like,
just because you have the end.
Yeah, like even with myself, like I don't shoot music like every like you know, mm-hmm. and that's something that people I think have to learn too. It's like relationships are key, and like you know, you have to have some self awareness to know like you know. Make sure your product is right. You know what I mean? And sometimes you have to go do it in other spaces before the people who are closest to you can really recognize it as well. God,
that's so true.
You know what I'm saying? So like there, it, you know, the fact that I left ESPN and I was doing these other things, like I was working at Pitbull's, you know, doing stuff at Pitbull studio and working with this artist and like doing these other things that wasn't reliant on my relationship necessarily directly to ESPN. The fact that I then had a relationship with ESPN helped secure it. But if I wasn't doing these other things, if I didn't have the product, if I wasn't out active working with, you know, like I said, you know, people in Pitbull's camp and at the studio, like being in those types of environments, I'm not getting those types of opportunities. And I think it's valuable for people who are continuing to grow in their respective fields, because I just hear so often, like, you know, and I get it, but it almost gets annoying how complacent people, you know, how much people can complain about lack of support or lack of whatever, like, you got to do the
work. But they're not out there doing the work, yeah. They're not out there networking, meeting people, like you said. That's so important, man.
And you could do the work and it's still not enough. But if you're not doing the work, there's somebody who's doing it. You know what I mean?
Somebody who's going to outwork you, man.
You know, so I'm glad to be in the space that I'm in right now and continuing to figure it out. You know what I mean? And I think that's what's key, is not allowing, you know, and I have to really follow my own advice on this accord, but like, Not allowing self-doubt and outside interference of, I remember when I left ESPN, I had random people hit me up on Facebook who I haven't talked to in years, like basically call me crazy or like, God. Why would you do that? And it's like, you know, all these different kind of things. And it's one of those things that, you know,
it's because people look at what you had as something they want.
Right.
So it's kind of like, you already have it, man. Like, you're giving up what I want, kind of.
probably. And it's, like, important to not give in to that. And it's important, even within your own self-doubts and insecurities, to really continue to fight.
To push yourself, man. Yeah.
And figure it out. I mean, even it's like a therapy session through this podcast or whatever. Like, even me, like, as I'm saying it, like I'm realizing it, you know, even going back like through the journey of me, so to speak, like of how that's kind of consistent through my process, and I would venture to say yours and other people, other creatives who continue to strive and figure out ways to reinvent themselves and continue to grow, is just having that, whatever that impulse is, that whatever that trait is, to, you know, no matter what's being thrown at you, is to figure it out. And that, you know, and you know, walking away from even like this podcast like that, I know that's the messaging that's gonna kind of even kind of ring in my own ear where it's like, hey, you know, you've gone through things before. You know what I mean? You know,
you have the knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. You've proven that you have the strength, the, like you said, the knowledge and the ability to do it. So, you know, let's figure it out. You know
what
I mean?
That's awesome, man. Well, thanks again, dude. Thanks again for coming by and telling your story. And it's because of networking that you're here. You know,
yeah.
It's because of Keza, and Keza kind of put us together. And yeah, that's why you're here. And you know,
yeah, man. Shouts out to you. Shouts out to Blue Box Digital. Shouts out to the podcast. And you know, again, I appreciate even having the platform to share the story, to share ideas and thoughts. And you know, even if one person comes across some of the videos and it motivates them, that's a win. And you know, obviously, you know,
yeah.
it shines a light to my brand. Hopefully, you know, it continues to help grow what you got going on here, because it's special, man. And I appreciate it again for being on.
Thank you, man. Yeah, I appreciate your kind words and I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're a busy man, so I appreciate you taking at least an hour and a half to kind of come by and tell your story, man. I really appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you, my brother.
Where can people find your stuff, man, online?
Yeah, Mr. Hit Record. So at Mr. Hit Record on Instagram. And I have a website link in my bio there on Instagram. It's the website's not completely finished, so I don't have the URL and stuff set up, but somebody can, like, it has enough there that you can kind of get, you know, a feel for some of the packages that I offer as a producer and as a songwriter and audio engineer, and some of the recent projects and stuff that I've worked on. So that's probably the best place to go ahead and you know, check me out, man.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And how many artists do you have so far? How many artists have you signed or have you
worked with? Right now, I mean, I've over the course of years, I've worked with thousands of artists, and from artists who have recorded their first songs to, you know, people that are household names or, you know, who have had records that everybody knows.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, nowadays, I've really started to highly focus on individualistic projects. And so there's a girl, Cheyenne Elliott, who I did a lot of the projects for, and she's Dionne Warwick's granddaughter and cousins to Whitney Houston. And we did a lot of cool R&B projects together, and she's got a couple of videos that are out. The artist Two Pistols, who's, you know, most known for the record She Got It with T-Pain. I did some projects with him, and one of which is a song called Fantasy. That I think it is probably his second most streamed song on Spotify, yeah, besides, you know, She Got It. And then the major artist, that I focus the most attention to right now is the girl Gabby B that I was speaking about.
Gabby, yeah, I remember seeing Gabby.
Yeah. So yeah, Gabby, I'm heavily like involved in the circumstances with her, from, you know, like we talked about, production and co-writing and, you know, getting involved in you know, the different sides of her rollouts and brand building and being able almost to be like a big brother, so to speak, in of the music industry, to be able to say, like, you know, these are some of the potholes and help mold that, but and do it in a way that's, you know, for this generation. And you know, I've been learning a lot from her in the camp, and just being around some of the new artists and how they approach certain things. And I'll say perspective is everything, you know what I mean? And to have the ability to be open to see things in a different perspective is important. But those are some of the projects. You can go on there, see some of the other ones. But right now, like I said, I think Gabby's the main artist that I've been really trying to help elevate, and hopefully she can become a even bigger household name than she already is as time progresses, and then maybe I can start to take on more as we get going, and like you said, maybe even start signing some of these artists to my own production company, and even thinking about opening up another going back and opening up a location, but up in Atlanta. So
a studio.
Yeah.
Studio location. You know, I thought you already had a studio up there.
I have one. It's in my house. And again, I usually use it more so for private sessions for things like, you know, artists like Gabby. And I just had like, you know, an artist from New York or, you know, like specific artists coming through. And we'll do like lockout sessions and whatever, gotcha. But it's not open to like the public. But that's where I do the majority of the things. But now that I'm in Atlanta and the area and great music market, a lot of talented people, I do kind of want to get in the mix more there. And I've been thinking that that might be the way to really do it, where I have a space, right? Like a creative space where it's like, you know, you just try to attract that energy and, you know, really, you know, I can hopefully build, and who knows who I can meet within that market. So
yeah, I mean, look where we are, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So. And hopefully, in the next 5 years, we'll be in a bigger, better studio with, you know, downtown somewhere. You know,
it's growth, man. And you know what? I know you'll figure it out.
Yes, sir. I'll figure it out. I'm a ninja at figuring it out, man.
Heck yeah, man.
Well, thanks again, man. I appreciate you for coming by at Mr. Hit Record. For us, it's going to be at Blue Box Podcast. We're on Instagram and on TikTok. We post 60-second highlights from the podcast if you don't have the full hour and a half to watch the whole thing. We got some merch. All the links are in the description if you want to check that out. We're on YouTube, youtube.blueboxdigital.com. And, yeah, that's enough links. Thanks again, man. I appreciate it. And we'll see you next time.
Until the next time, my brother. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thanks.